We'll now begin the final session of our three-day gathering, and the last two papers are dedicated to aspects of film, one of the most dynamic developments of the modernist age in Central Europe. Just keep in mind that the building, unfortunately, even though Central Europe and our engagement with it continues far into the night, the building does close its doors, so therefore we will have to vacate. So with that caution, I invite to the podium Maria Michaela, who will speak to us today on Schein und Sein, Identity in Fritz Lang's Metropolis.
And very happy I am to be here, I have to say, after the last 4 hours of wondering whether the images would in fact get translated correctly. We had an image catastrophe. So, but all is well, thanks to the help of Sam and Liz and the nice people here at the New York Public who lent me a computer and gave me much help, and here we are. Okay. On the 8th of January, 1923, a film long in production premiered in Berlin at the Uferpalast am Zoo, the flagship cinema of Germany's largest film producer. Eponymously titled after the name of the man who was both its star and producer, the Steinach film was Uffe's first feature-length documentary, playing 70 minutes in length to audiences who packed the 2,100-seat cinema several times a day for weeks. Its subject, the so-called sex glands, the role they play in gender formation, and most sensationally, physical and sexual rejuvenation through vasectomies. 4 years later, almost to the day, another film, years in the making, premiered as well at the Uferpalast am Zoo. Opening on the 10th of January, 1927, Metropolis was not a documentary, nor was its narrative in any way about the sex glands or achieving eternal youth. But I will argue today that these two films are nonetheless related in significant ways. Among them, the manner in which both deal with bodies transformed by technology. I will further suggest that a key theme of Metropolis, the chaos that results from mistaken identity, owes much to the popularization of research in endocrinology, like that presented in the Steinach film, and to other medical and technological developments that were similarly thought to efface traditional markers of identity. Finally, in keeping with the theme of this conference, that is modernity in Central Europe, I will propose that modern culture in Germany was especially inflected by a preoccupation more widespread than elsewhere for a variety of reasons with the authentic and inauthentic, with, as the title of my talk proposes, Sein and Schein. But first, a brief recap of Metropolis. The story imagined by director Fritz Lang and screenwriter Thea von Harbou is set in the future in the city of Metropolis, seen here in a sketch by set designer Erich Kettelhut that served as the opening scene of the film. Below ground are the masses of nameless workers who spend their lives servicing Metropolis's machines in grueling 10-hour shifts in which frequent fatal accidents occur. Among the movie's most striking sequence is the explosion of this machine, the filming of which was covered by journalists invited by Uffe to witness the carefully staged event. Above ground are the elite, led by the master of them all, Jo Frederson. The master's son, Freder, has lived a life of luxury, playing sports with the other sons of the elite in a stadium specially built for them, and cavorting in a pleasure garden with women whose sole purpose is to entertain him. He has had no thought for others until he encounters a young woman from below, Maria, who appears above ground with a group of workers' children. The religious symbolism of Maria's name and function here as the humble mother of the weak and oppressed is typical of much of the film and is reinforced by costume designer Anna Wilkom's decision to emulate images of the Madonna when designing Maria's dress. Freder is transfixed by the sight of Maria, and he follows her into the depths where he experiences the harshness of life firsthand after exchanging clothes and positions with a worker. The visual allusion of this moment in the film to Christ is underscored by the subsequent scene in which Maria preaches patience to the workers and tells them that someone will surely soon come to mediate between them and the masters, a heart who will link the hands and the brain. Meanwhile, up above, Jo Frederson is visiting Rotbang, the only person in the city who can hold his own with the master of Metropolis. Rotbang has a complicated relationship with Frederson. The love of his life, a woman named Hel, had abandoned him to marry Frederson and died while giving birth to Freder. Devastated, Rotbang constructed a monument to her memory, which he keeps behind curtains in his home and which Frederson discovers while visiting. But the monument is just stone, and Rotbang has been hard at work on a flesh and blood replacement for Hel. Though not quite done, he introduces the prototype to Frederson, who, having learned of the bond between Maria and the workers, asks Rotbang to make her in the likeness of Maria so that discord can be sowed between them. Illogical, to be sure, since Maria preached patience to the workers, not revolt, and thus poses no threat to Frederson. And equally illogical is Rotbang's acquiescence, since the robot was originally intended to become the new Hel, not Frederson's handmaid. Nevertheless, Maria is captured and brought to Rotbang's laboratory, where the transformation begins. The scenes in which this happens are doubtless the most spectacular in the entire film, and among the most interesting to me, and show Maria encased in an apparatus that is attached by wires to the seated robot, her head enclosed by a metal cap with diodes. Rotbang moves about, checking instruments here, throwing switches there, and so initiating the duplication process that is made visible to us by rings of light that move up and down and around the robot's body in a caress, not unlike that of Pygmalion embracing his statue come to life, save for the fact that this embrace is mechanical. The procedure complete, Maria is released from captivity, and the robot, identical to her except that she is not chaste and virtuous, but sexual and illicit, leaves Rotbang's house and begins to wreak havoc in Metropolis. Her first stop is to introduce herself to Jo Frederson, and it is at his office that Sun Freder sees them together, believes himself to have been betrayed, and falls psychically ill. In the next scenes, Rotbang introduces her to the elite of Metropolis at a nightclub. Backlit, she rises up out of a vessel surrounded by disembodied eyes, and begins to dance slowly and provocatively, the shape of her body clearly outlined through the diaphanous shawl. Her dance then speeds up, and the robot becomes a whirling dervish, hypnotizing the audience. When it is finally over, the men are completely in her spell, and fights ensue as they vie for her affection. The robot, then makes her way underground, where here too she unleashes chaos. Telling the workers there is no more time for patience, she incites them to revolt, and they destroy the machines that control Metropolis. Only later will they realize that this destruction has caused their homes to flood and that their children are in danger. It is Maria who saves them by ringing the gong at the center of town to get their attention and then bringing them through the underground passages up to the city above. She is ultimately helped by Freder, who in the interim has realized the deception and roused himself from his sickbed. In the end, everyone catches on, and the robot is caught, then burned at the stake in front of the cathedral. This is also where the final reconciliation scene occurs, in which Freder brokers peace between his father and the foreman of the workers, fulfilling Maria's earlier prophecy that the heart will mediate between the brain and the hands. Metropolis was not a critical success. To be sure, almost everyone praised the stunning special effects. But Germany's major film critics pilloried the ending of Metropolis, which was almost universally decried as sappy and sentimental. Critics were also put off by the murky mixture of Christianity, socialism, and Nietzscheanism, which resulted in what Herbert Jahring termed an ideological film without an ideology. From the United States, H.G. Wells contributed his own damning review, spoofing the idea of a slave population servicing machines that produce nothing, and of a master so inattentive to industrial efficiency that he drove his workers to the point of exhaustion. For him, The crowning imbecility of the film was the conversion of the robot into the likeness of Mary, or Maria. He did not understand, he said, why Maria has to be trapped, put into a machine like a translucent cocktail shaker, and undergo all sorts of pyrotechnic treatment in order that her likeness may be transferred to the robot. The possibility of Rodvang just simply making a robot like her evidently never entered the gifted producer's head. Notably, nobody in Germany seemed to find this unusual, however much they disliked other aspects of the film. And it is this that I would like to use as my point of departure for an interpretation of the film that roots it in contemporary debates about technology and the body. This issue has, of course, been at the center of many investigations of Metropolis, and though time precludes me from addressing these today in any significant way, my thinking about this topic has been informed by those scholars who have, from different perspectives, considered how the film relates machines to both male and female bodies. I would like to build on this work by elaborating a discourse about the body and technology that, to my knowledge, has not yet been considered in relation to Metropolis. Specifically, I want to consider the population in Germany especially of certain medical and technological advances that had the effect of effacing markers of bodily identity, be they of gender, age, class, or ethnicity. I will also attend today to both the anxiety and enthusiasm that this perceived blurring of identity provoked. In this regard, I want to call attention to an aspect of Metropolis that is seldom noted, which is the chaos that results at key points in the story from the misidentification of the robot as Maria. The first is when Prater sees the robot with his father and thinks himself to have been deceived. This causes him to become so distraught that he takes to his bed, leaving Maria to deal alone with what is going on in the workers' city. The second takes place in the nightclub, when the elite of Metropolis mistake the robot for a flesh and blood woman and are so inflamed by passion that they end up rioting. And then the third is when the robot descends into the catacombs and incites the workers, who believe her to be the good Maria and so follow her advice. In each of these cases, disaster occurs because a complicated technical medical procedure that had transformed one body into another made it impossible for the inhabitants of Metropolis to identify the real Maria. This returns me to the Steinach film and its star and producer, the endocrinologist Eugen Steinach, who, as it happens, was much in the news when Long and Harbou were first conceiving the film's narrative in 1923. The study of the endocrine glands had its beginnings in the 1880s, but it was in the first two decades of the 20th century when much of the pioneering research occurred. The so-called sex glands, the testicles and the ovaries, attracted the particular attention of endocrinologists, of whom Steinach was doubtless the most famous. First in articles and books targeted primarily to the scientific community, and then in his sensational and wildly popular film of 1923, he publicized experiments in which he had, among other things, transplanted ovaries into male rats and guinea pigs and observed the development of female physical characteristics and behavior, and testicles into females in which he observed the opposite. Based on these experiments, Steinach argued that the characteristics of sex, body build, breasts, internal and external genitals, sexual orientation, mating rituals, were all generated by testicular and ovarian hormones, described at the time not as testosterone or estrogen, but as glandular juices or secretions. He further posited that the hormones of those who had the physical and psychic characteristics of the opposite sex were simply out of whack, such as the feminine man and masculine woman here, who he featured in his film. Steinach even found a way, he claimed, to correct the imbalance by maladept hormones, at least in men. And he introduced the procedure to his 1923 viewing public in one graphic sequence of the film. My apologies for this. Having found a heterosexual donor, he removed a testicle, then implanted it into the groin of one of his homosexual patients, and its glandular secretions were said indeed to be sufficient to effect the desired shift in both behavior and appearance. Steinach's notion that glandular juices wholly determined one's sex and gender quickly became the stuff of popular culture in the early to mid-1920s, when articles on endocrinology proliferated in the German mass media. These were illustrated, often with images of individuals who had both male and female sex characteristics, such as this man with breasts, or this woman with facial hair, of which much more could be said than that about that particular image. Or with photographs of transgendered persons like this man or these four women. Purportedly undetected by others, such individuals not only cross-dressed publicly, they even practiced professions suitable to members of the opposite sex. In short, by early 1923, the seed of mistrust in vision as a means of discerning gender identity had been planted in the popular imagination. And we can talk about that date later. The indefatigable Steinach did not stop there, however, but rather went on to research rejuvenation, publicizing his results again in articles, books, and his film. He had noted in his experiments with rats and guinea pigs that the physical characteristics of masculinity or femininity diminished in old age. Since those characteristics were determined by testicular or ovarian hormones, he reasoned that the aging suffered from a deficiency of such hormones. If their gonads could be encouraged to produce more, then the sexual characteristics would be reinvigorated, and the individuals might also regain some of the general vitality of youth. How to do this? Steinach claimed that vasectomies were the answer. Having subjected senile rats to this minor operation and found that the once lethargic, underweight, and almost lifeless animals, one of which you see above, became active, gained weight, developed a glossy new fur, and regained sexual interest. And that would be the one below. I could have shown you other images of that. He then went on to perform vasectomies on men, again introducing the procedure to the public in his film, and I'm going to spare you from that, but it was a long, explicit sequence, which described how the cutting of the spermatic cord would promote the rejuvenation of the testicle and foster production of the hormones that would then go on to reinvigorate the entire body. His patients, he said, demonstrated the success of the operation. This 70-year-old man, seen in senile condition on the left and incapable of practicing his profession as a salesman of carpentry tools, gained weight, improved his muscular and skin tone, increased energy, and resumed his trade, which involved carrying heavy bags of equipment door to door. I should say that I had some better slides that got lost in the drama today, the appearance was more dramatically improved than in this particular case. The equivalent procedure for women, tubal ligations, proved less successful. But for them, organotherapy was said to provide an alternative. This involved the sex glands of both large and small animals as the source of testicular and ovarian extracts that were prepared quite literally by squeezing out the organic secretions, much as one would the juice of an orange. These extracts were then administered as infusions that allegedly had a rapid and pronounced effect on the body. I don't know about the rabbit here. I don't know. I don't know whether that was the source of the glands that is reinvigorating this woman, or it's there as a kind of stuffed animal for comfort, or if it's the caption didn't say anything about it. According to one doctor whose clinic in Charlottenburg specialized in glandular extracts and ovarian radiation treatments that were also said to be extremely effective, women could be rejuvenated by as much as 10 years, and no one would know by looking at them how old they really were. Again, let me emphasize that these rejuvenation techniques were the stuff of German popular culture in the early to mid-1920s, widely discussed and illustrated in the mass media, as is indicated by these snippets of reviews of Steinach's film in papers as diverse as Vorwärts and Die Rote Fahne. My apologies for the blurred slide on the right. It is thus hardly surprising that no one in Germany wondered about the procedure used by Rotwang to give the robot Maria's likeness, as did H.G. Wells from his perspective in America. For Germans, inundated as they were with images of and stories about rejuvenation, successful bodily makeovers that could fool others occurred only via complicated chemical, medical, and technical procedures. Still, Rotwang is not your run-of-the-mill scientist. His long robe, unruly hair, and medieval house decorated with a five-pointed star that is associated with the occult code him as a kind of sorcerer or alchemist who creates Maria's robotic twin as much by magic as by science. I would now like to turn to one other technological innovation, much in the news in the 1920s, that was also sometimes discussed by way of reference to alchemy, an innovation particularly relevant to the issues of reproduction and replacement. The alchemist you see here, more puckish elf than crazed sorcerer, is producing rayon, known in German as Kunstseide, or artificial silk, because of the way it mimicked many of silk's characteristics. The world's first synthetic fiber, made by forcing the viscous form of cellulose through tiny holes in spinnerets and then treating the extruded filaments with a chemical bath, rayon was invented in the 1880s in France and England and used initially only as an effect fiber in notions. But when Germany was blockaded by England during World War I, it was forced to develop an ersatz fiber suitable for yard goods, since it imported almost all of the raw materials it used to make cloth and now could no longer get them. Cellulose, as the chief component of plants and trees, was plentiful within its own borders, and so German chemists turned their efforts toward perfecting rayon. Already by 1917, that is much earlier than anywhere else as far as I've been able to determine, women's clothing in Germany was being made regularly out of artificial silk, like the dark skirt under the lace pinafore on the right and the striped skirt on the left. Though initially rayon had a high sheen that for some was not entirely desirable, as well as a tendency to wrinkle, with time producers learned to deluster the yarn, to minimize wrinkling, and to capitalize on the fiber's inherent drape, which was especially suited for the loose, boxy shapes of 1920s fashion. Notably, and this is what is really of interest to me in this regard anyway, rayon was considerably less expensive than real silk, even as it mimicked many of silk's characteristics. When Metropolis premiered in 1927, the cheapest grades of rayon cost about three-quarters the price of real silk, while medium-grade yard goods and products, like this dress that women could buy off the rack at Wertheim, cost about half the price of comparable silk wares. Even Bembag, the finest and most expensive grade of rayon, which 98% of consumers reported was indistinguishable from real silk, cost about one-quarter its price. For the first time, women of modest means, who previously could only have worn wool or cotton because they could not afford silk, could purchase stockings and clothing that simulated silk in look and feel. As one writer put it in 1928, it's now difficult for the well-off lady to call attention to her status through outward appearances. To be sure, the higher quality of her clothing might distinguish her, but such quality will be obvious only to the cultivated, trained eye. Superficially, the clothes are exactly the same. If the judge's wife wears a fur with a pure silk lining, the unmarried factory worker will wear a fake fur with artificial silk lining, and both will look equally elegant. If the wealthy cosmopolitan clads her legs in the finest silk stockings, the calves of her less financially fortunate sister will also shimmer, but in artificial silk, and no one will be able to tell the difference. No one will be able to tell the difference, be it the difference between male and female, young and old, or upper and lower class. True or not, that was what many Germans of the 1920s believed, or at least this is what I'm arguing, just as they also believed that one's ethnicity could now be masked by increasingly popular cosmetic surgery, or by the many more inexpensive alternatives, such as the gadget you see here, that could tame untoward noses. To be sure, men the world over had the Steinach operation, women everywhere ultimately wore rayon, and Jews in America ultimately had their noses fixed just as they did in Germany. But because many of these procedures and innovations were first pioneered and then widely publicized in Germany via Weimar's famed mass media, the perception, I'm arguing, was stronger here than elsewhere. The boundaries were permeable and identity opaque. The sharp increase beginning around 1923 of books and periodicals devoted to topology, graphology, palmistry, and astrology speaks to this point. Believing themselves incapable of gauging character on the basis of physical appearance or clothing, Germans turned to other means like handwriting, body posture, palms, or the stars. This returns me to my proposal that the cultural production of Weimar Germany was inflected by issues of identity more so than elsewhere. Metropolis is doubtless the best-known film in which the narrative turns on a case of mistaken identity, but so too does Robert Wiene's Cabinet of Dr. Caligari or Ernst Lubitsch's I Wouldn't Like to Be a Man and his The Oyster Princess. New objectivity is similarly concerned with the perceived perceptual difficulty of discerning identity, but rather than elaborate on the chaos that results from confusions about identity, it works to render it manifest. And here we return to Zander. The photographer August Zander is perhaps best known for this. He dedicated his entire life to producing a kind of cultural and class history of the Weimar era, one which allowed viewers to pin down more firmly the face of the times. That's this title of the 1929 selection of Zander's photographs that we've mentioned several times today. Then they could through everyday perception. By capturing his sitters either frontally or in profile in an overall even light that minimizes dramatic effects, and cropping the photos so that all the figures occupy more or less the same amount of space within the frame, Zander created a consistency of image that allowed contemporary viewers to see their differences of dress, physiognomy, and comportment, differences that many feared were then being effaced. New objectivity painters likewise tried to render the opacity of identity transparent with their many images of professional and social types, be they big or small-time capitalists like Heinrich Maria Davringhausen's The Profiteer of 1921 on your left, or Grete Jürgens, the cloth merchants of 1932, with what one could argue are strongly anti-Semitic overtones. Laborers like Otto Griebel's Shipstoker of 1920, or white-collar workers like Wilhelm Schoenberg's 1923 Portrait of an Architect. And I might mention just parenthetically here, of course, Helmut Leighton's argument that typological and taxonomic analyses tend to abound at times when cultures are perceived to be in disarray because they impose a kind of structural security on that. Notably, the style of new objectivity is precisely rendered and carefully composed, as if sharp contours, smooth surfaces, and an aesthetic of order could somehow contain the unsettling dissolution of class, age, ethnic, professional, and gender boundaries that typified the era. And for those of you who don't know this marvelous painting by Anton Reiterscheidt, it is a self-portrait of the artist of 1928. By contrast, other Weimar-era artists celebrated the effacement of clear-cut and stable identity, Hanna Höch among them. She used the medium of photomontage to effect the kind of bodily transformations that German surgeons achieved in the operating room, combining the young and old, the male and female, the animal and human. Hirsch tried to erase, as she put it, the firm boundaries that we human beings so self-assuredly are inclined to erect around everything. Her friend Kurt Schwitters came at it from a different, though related angle, using his ever-changing Märzbau to preserve traces of his friend's identities in its nooks and crannies, then covering them up with more mats in an aesthetic that quietly counters new objectivity's insistence on rendering things stable and inert. In closing, I would like to return to Metropolis and propose that its filmic body, like so many other bodies of the Weimar era, does not disclose its identity in any clear-cut way, either to contemporary viewers or to us. As I mentioned, Long and Harbou appear to have conceived of the story in 1923, just when the Steinach film was being screened throughout Germany. Harbou then went on to write three versions of the story, a serialized novel that was published in an illustrated newspaper at the end of 1926, a hardcover and paperback novel that were released when the film premiered in January of 1927, and then, of course, the screenplay to the film itself. All of these versions are different, and it is still not entirely clear which was written first, which was the original. As regards the film itself, very few people actually saw the version that premiered in January of 1927, which had a running time of about 153 minutes. For its American release, and many of you will know this, the film was cut to 107 minutes, in part to excise the portions of the narrative that referred to hell, because of concerns about the similarity in the spelling of her name to the English word H-E-L-L. Though this muddied the plot rather significantly, UFA nevertheless adopted the American version when it became clear that the long German version was not doing well in Germany. This is the one that Germans in the provinces saw beginning in April 1927, until a second German version, just slightly longer than the American, was released in August. Running 117 minutes in length, it was the only version in which the film could be seen until 2001, when a reconstructed version of the original was released. But even this is missing about 30 of the original 153 minutes, which have never been found. Ironically, then, a film that is in large part about confusion of identity is itself confused in identity, and as such is perhaps the quintessential exemplar of Weimar Germany's engagement with this vexing issue. Thank you very much.
Responses, questions, confusions.
I should say, before anybody asks anything, that the drama with the slides has probably used up all my brain capacity, so please forgive me if I'm not as eloquent as I normally like to think I am.
Please.
Yeah, I do. For those of you that don't know, there is a book called Das Kunstseidene Mädchen, The Artificial Silk Girl by Irmgard Coyn, that was written in 1932. And of course, that's sort of the classic connection to artificial silk. I actually think that most people don't know a lot of the references that are in that book are really to artificial silk, such as when, for example, she pilfers Bemberg stockings. It's called Bemberg silk stockings, but it's really artificial silk, and anybody at that time absolutely would have known that. So she is pilfering, really, sort of a high-class rayon that was very similar to silk, giving her access to the kinds of social situations that she otherwise would not have had. And I actually think that book is much more optimistic about her position and what's going to happen to her afterwards than most people have thought about. She's this girl from the provinces who goes to Berlin in the hope of becoming a film star, and she progressively works her way down the social ladder bit by bit. But I think it ends actually on a good note. One interesting thing about that is that there was this debate, not a debate, there was actually a lawsuit in the late 20s, it was carried on into the early 30s, about artificial silk and silk. The silk producing companies sued Bemberg over the issue of, I showed that one slide where it said Bemberg Seide, for using the term silk and not saying it was artificial silk. And they lost time after time and appeal after appeal because the courts ruled that it was close enough to silk and that anyway it didn't matter anymore.
I wonder if there's a polar opposite at work. One of the things that you showed so eloquently was the effacing of differences, That is, you can use a set of artifices to disguise or mask differences. And I wonder whether there was also at work one that exaggerated differences. I mean, if one looks at other moments of instability or social shifting, one thinks of the 1960s, and there would be one to be black but more than black, to be Hispanic, ultra-Hispanic. Mm-hmm. Again, to celebrate it, to act out parts, to wear garb, or to distort figures, one's own figure, mm-hmm. in order to celebrate difference. Mm-hmm. Was there any of this here? That is, you showed one side, but I wonder whether there was a flip side that was at work. We saw it again this morning in some of the looks of the Die Juden im Osten. Mm-hmm. Again, a type of reworking, one might even say a leveling of differences. But I wonder here whether there was an exaggeration of difference. I think one can look at some of the new objectivity as a celebration of extremity. But I wonder what...
Well, my point that I was trying to make with new objectivity, which maybe I didn't make so well, was really that it was an attempt to pin down sort of before they all disappeared.
Well, that I understood. I'm just trying to take it a little bit earlier, as you did here with 1923 and 24, that here this whole sense of transference, mm-hmm. that in a sense with nose jobs, that there's a type of nose that is the ideal that one aspires mm-hmm. to, or a sexuality, or whatever one needs, that there mm-hmm. are standards to which one should adhere, or at least approach. And I'm suggesting, is it possible that there's an opposite at work, that we're choosing not to look at?
Maybe. So, are you thinking of something in particular?
Well, nothing comes to mind right here in this context, but perhaps in others, yes.
So
there are other voices being not so much about deceiving, but that this is about actually the moral point, authentic existence of people of deceiving and perception and actually
deceiving. Yeah. Well, and interestingly, Steinach was involved with Hirschfeld in those two images that I showed of the man with the breasts and her name was Julia Pastrana. She was supposedly a Mexican ballet dancer. That they came from his archive. And that's true. I mean, those images do celebrate isn't the right word, but they certainly acknowledge the extreme difference.
We have time for two more questions. Yes, please.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And now I realize you have this slide problem, but I'm wondering if you have any idea in terms of how some of this, you talked about the Germans having this sense of that, well, bodily transformations have to go through all of this medicalization. Mm-hmm.
There doesn't seem to be that sort of fascination with topology or class. No.
Well, there's topology, because in like most illustrated magazines, a typical
but is through screened through kind of a national lens rather than. Well, yeah. I need more time to. Yeah, I mean, I need more. Not necessarily. I didn't mean in my presentation per se. I just don't know enough yet. This is my sort of suspicion, really, just on the basis of what I know about American art from this time period or French art. I know much less about Eastern Europe and would be really curious to, I'm very interested to hear that, that it tends to come from a kind of ethnographic angle rather than about gender.
And one final quick question, please. Yes.
Operas from that time period?
No, all operas.
Oh, all right, you're all operas, you're right, that's true.
Right.
Right. Something else that I have to think about some more is, in fact, how limited it is this to the 1920s and early 1930s, which is what I'm supposing, because I need to do a bigger, broader study, I suppose, is what I'm saying. Nobody, you know, I didn't mention the word Nazis deliberately. And I was sure one of you would, but I'm glad you didn't, because that's another thing that I really haven't thought through yet, the relation of all of this to what comes.
I'm afraid we're going to have to stop there, but thank you so very, very much. It was beautifully done.